You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, welcome back to episode 33 of the Untaming podcast. I hope you enjoyed the last episode with Anita and Nathan of the Homeschool Project podcast. Their interview of me is being released today, so if you're interested in hearing more about my life, travelling, living off-grid in Portugal and rewilding, there's a good start. So this week my four-year-old son wrote down some of his favourite letters, and I realised that I could use most of them to form the word feast, and he was so excited about that he spent the next 2 days writing feast everywhere. He even wanted to write it on a piece of paper and put it in a random person's letterbox. And then, because his absolute favourite animal is a cheetah, I showed him how to write cheetah. So since then, he has been writing cheetah feast everywhere, even in the sand at the beach with our unschooling group the other day. Today's episode with Jill Rapley is a good one if you are interested in introducing foods to babies. Among many things, we talked about how with parent-led feeding, babies are given more solid food than they need earlier on, and this ultimately leads to them taking in less milk than they need. It made me think of, I don't know about you, but at least in my culture, I often get asked if my daughter is a good eater, and I always answer yes, because she quite happily eats a wide range of food, from homemade kimchi to mussels to milk kefir to seaweed. She especially loves her leafy greens. They're usually the first thing she reaches for. In fact, the only foods she'll ever turn down are either really low nutrient carbs like white bread, or a food item that we've eaten a lot of to the point that she's sick of it, which I take as a sign that she has an awareness of her own nutritional needs rather than just her caloric needs, which is a physical understanding that I think a lot of us as adults have lost with our modern diets. But anyway, I'm digressing from my point. So I respond that she is a good eater because she enjoys a wide range of foods, but she is still predominantly breastfed. So her actual food intake is quite small. Like 1 to 3 mouthfuls is often enough for her for a whole meal. Whereas my culture considers a good eater one who just eats a lot of food. Next week's episode is with Jacqueline Wolf, a professor of social medicine. She shares with us the dramatic history of cesarean sections, the history of obstetrics and gynecology, and the pathologizing of conception, pregnancy, and birth. But for now, here is Jill. Oh, and I will warn you that I recorded this episode not long after the last episode with Nathan and Anita, so I was still sounding slightly congested at the time, so I apologise in advance. Sixty-four-year-old Jill Rapley was born and grew up in Kent. She currently lives there with her husband. They have 3 grown-up children and a new grandchild. Dr. Rapley has studied infant feeding and child development for many years, gaining a master's degree in 2005 and a PhD in 2015. She is known internationally as the pioneer of the approach to complementary solid feeding, known as baby-led weaning, which she developed as part of her master's degree and pursued for her PhD. She worked as a public health nurse for more than 20 years, and has also been a midwife, lactation consultant, breastfeeding counsellor, lecturer, writer and researcher. Jill is the co-author of 5 books on infant feeding and parenting, and the author of a number of professional and academic articles. Last night she probably had about 7 to 8 hours of sleep, and for dinner tonight she had leek, potato and chicken soup from leftover roast chicken. Jill, welcome to the show.
Hi Emily, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So I first heard about baby-led weaning before I had children from a friend who was doing it with her daughter. and I found the idea fascinating, though I found the name slightly confusing, and I think because, at least here in New Zealand, the word weaning refers to the process of a child ending their breastfeeding journey. But I think I've come to understand that this is just a difference in our use of the word. Is that right?
It is, but there's a little bit more to it than that. On the face of it, you're absolutely right that, in fact, in a lot of countries, the word weaning means the end of breastfeeding. In some countries, that also incorporates formula feeding. In others, the minute you stop, you move from breast to bottle, you're in fact weaning your baby. So there are differences even within that definition. In the UK, it's always been the case that the word weaning referred to the introduction of solid food. So, you know, it's sort of whatever it might have been at the time, way back when we were doing it as early as 2 weeks, then 3 months, 4 months, and nowadays 6 months. But I like to use the word actually in its fullest sense, which incorporates both of those things. So weaning is a very gradual process that lasts at least several months and possibly several years. And it begins with the very first mouthful of anything other than breast milk or formula. I like to include both. So the very first mouthful of solid food, in other words, and it ends with the very last breast or formula feed. So it's going to begin at whatever age the parents decide to introduce solid foods, but it might end well into toddlerhood. And actually, the whole of that is weaning. So the bit that I'm most interested in is the beginning of weaning, and the bit that you're referring to is the end of weaning. The reason I like to stick to that definition is to make it clear that I'm not talking about ending breastfeeding, but also to acknowledge that it's about the control the baby has over that process. And there are already a lot of books out there and discussions about how breastfeeding should end, whether it should be the mom or the baby who decides the timing. But until recently, we haven't really talked about whether the baby could be involved in deciding the beginning of that whole process, that very first mouthful of solid food. That's been something that's been decided for the baby. So baby-led weaning incorporates the whole of it, both ends, but I'm primarily interested in the beginning.
And so then, can you define for us what baby-led weaning is?
Well, yeah, it's I think you used the word approach to the introduction of solid foods, and I prefer that to a method. It's not a method of feeding. It's an approach to the introduction of solid foods that allows the control to remain with the baby. So the parent provides, the baby decides. The baby decides what to eat from what's on offer, when, how much, how fast, when to stop, and so on. The parent is just involved in providing healthy food for the baby. So it does revolve around healthy food, a balanced diet, shared family meal times. But it's the baby who actually does the feeding. He or she feeds themselves with pieces of food that are big enough for them to pick up and grasp and take to their mouth themselves. So it's really a kind of an ethos of respect and trust for babies and giving them control, rather than simply a question. In fact, you'll notice in that definition, I haven't even talked about spoon feeding or purees because it's so much more than that.
Yes. And I guess to clarify, you kind of already said this, but it's not about introducing solid foods as a replacement for breastfeeding, right?
Absolutely right, yeah. Breast milk is all a baby needs for the first 6 months, but actually there's very little, even at that point, that they need in addition. Extremely small amounts of just a few micronutrients, not quantities of food. And in fact, one of the problems with the traditional or conventional way of introducing solids is that the amounts are determined by the parents, and usually quite a lot is given, even from the very beginning. So the baby will therefore tend to take less milk. With the baby-led weaning approach, and in fact the research backs this up, the quantity of milk that the baby takes is greater for longer with the baby-led approach.
Right, yeah. And I guess because the approach now has a name, baby-led weaning, then it's thought of as some new side, kind of newfangled idea. But from a historical point of view, is this really just the way we've always introduced foods to babies?
Yeah, I think it probably is about as old as humankind. It certainly isn't new, even in kind of, you know, the memory of people around now. It's not new. There are plenty of people who whose grandmothers say, oh, yeah, that's what we did. You know, we didn't have any of these fancy blenders and all that. We just gave the baby our food. And many, many mums, you know, with young children now who've got, let's say, three or more children, say, oh, yeah, I could, with the third one, I couldn't be bothered with all that faffing about. That's what I, you know, I just let them help themselves. So it's not only not new, it's kind of always been here and still is. What's different is that it didn't have a name, so people couldn't talk about it. So the very fact that we can now have discussions about, are you doing conventional weaning or are you doing baby-led, those discussions weren't possible in the past because there was just spoon-feeding or something that you didn't talk about or that you didn't share because you felt a bit guilty that you weren't doing things properly. What it's done now is come out of the closet.
So do you have any idea why we went through that period of using purees and spoon feeding?
Well, as far as I can tell, it was simply because we thought, and we genuinely thought, that babies younger than 6 months who weren't yet able to pick up food and take it to their own mouth did need solid food. So the only way you're going to get food into the mouth of a baby that young is to put it there. And because they haven't got chewing skills yet, it has to be in quite a soft or runny pureed form. So essentially they more or less drink it. So it was kind of, there were genuine reasons. The problem is that what we haven't realised is that those were the reasons. Instead, we see spoon feeding and purees as just being part of babyhood. And at whatever stage you start, that's how you've got to start. And that's where we're quite wrong. And actually, if we introduce it at the age where babies are naturally kind of programmed to want other foods, we don't need to bother with all of that messing about.
So this next question is a bit of a two-prong question. What are the issues with introducing foods too early, and what are the signs of readiness to look for when a child can begin tasting foods?
Okay, so introducing foods too early. Well, we know from research that there are all sorts of reasons why that's not a good idea. Especially when the baby's breastfed, they really don't need anything until 6 months. And we know that diluting the amount of breast milk they're having or replacing it in any way in that time, in that first half year, can expose them to illnesses, infections, and so on. The rates of almost every illness are higher if the baby is started on anything other than breast milk before 6 months. Clearly, it's not quite the same if the baby is formula fed, in the sense that they're already missing out on some of the benefits of breastfeeding. So it's possibly a slightly different picture, but we still have evidence that starting solid foods early is more likely to lead to overweight and possibly issues with picky eating later on. Although there's quite a big argument, possibly pushed a bit by industry, who would like still to be carrying on selling products to baby food products from 4 months onwards, there's this move that, oh well, it doesn't do any harm, so why don't we do it? I'm definitely of the view that if it doesn't do any proven good, then we shouldn't risk it. But as to signs of readiness, again, those have sort of changed, except they haven't. It's just that we misinterpreted babies' behaviours in the past. When I first qualified as a health visitor, which is the equivalent more or less to a public health nurse in other countries, we were taught that, you know, when a baby perhaps his weight gain slows down slightly, or he's looking at his parents eating, or is not sleeping through the night anymore, that those were signs that the baby was ready for solid foods. But actually, those were just signs that the baby was 4 months old. And we had decided that 4 months was the age that you might want to start. In fact, immediately before I qualified, we were in a transition period, moving in the UK anyway, from a general principle of starting at around 3 months. And so already I found that colleagues of mine were struggling to explain to mums why, with their first baby, they'd been told, or when he's shoving his fist in his mouth, that shows he's ready for solids. And by the time the second baby arrived, they were told, no, that isn't a sign. Actually, we need to look at his weight, and we need to look at whether he's sleeping through the night. And we haven't actually learned that neither of those were signs of readiness for solid foods. They were just signs of normal behavior at that particular age. So now we've shifted to 6 months. We actually must be a bit wary about just doing the same thing again and just talking about what the baby can and can't do because of his age. So we're really looking for markers that are definitely related to feeding. And those would be in terms of safety, being able to sit upright and hold his trunk steady and his head steady and reach out and grab things without toppling over. He doesn't have to be able to sit by himself in the middle of the floor for any particular length of time. In fact, he may even need a bit of stability around his hips. But essentially, he's got the strength, the core strength and the balance to be able to reach out without unbalancing, and that he tends to bring everything to his mouth. But things like watching parents eating still happen at around 4 months. It's just we recognize those are part of the baby's build-up and general interest in the world around him. They're not related to food needs. The other thing I just want to say as well is that what motivates the baby isn't hunger. This isn't about hunger from his point of view. He can still get everything he needs from his milk feeds. What motivates him is interest in his world and curiosity and wanting to mimic what other people are doing. His frame of reference for watching his parents eating and getting excited about it is just that it's another interesting thing to watch. It's no different from watching them on their mobile phones or driving a car or brushing their hair. He doesn't understand what it is they're doing, and he certainly doesn't relate it to his own belly and his feeling of fullness after a milk feed, which is one of the reasons why the advice parents are often given to try their baby with solid foods when he's hungry is a quick route to disaster, because from the baby's point of view, he's trying to say, no, I don't want this. I want my food. I want my milk. The other thing I'd quite like to say about signs of readiness is that there are a couple of signs of readiness which I'm not happy to share, really, or to agree with. One is that the tongue thrust reflex has disappeared. That's a reflex present in younger babies, which essentially stops them being fed, makes spoon feeding very difficult. It's the thing that makes them kind of spit out the mouthful, so you have to scoop it up and put it back in again. That's usually disappearing from around 4 months onwards. But it's not a sign of readiness for solid foods. Again, it's a sign of the baby's age, that's all. And the thing that really I find difficult, if we're going to use it as a sign of readiness for solid foods, is that we have to test for it. And how are you going to test for that without putting something into the baby's mouth? The other problem I have with it is that parents often mistake it for a baby actually just wanting to lick the food that they're picking up. So a baby will pick up a piece of food, take it to his mouth, put out his tongue to lick it, and the parents will say, oh my god, he hasn't lost his tongue thrust, what's happening, maybe he's not ready. That's not a tongue thrust reflex, that's an active exploratory movement using his mouth. And the other key supposed sign of readiness is that the baby can swallow food. And again, in the same way, my question is, how are you going to test for that? You know?
Yeah.
Plus which, if baby-led weaning and babies moving on to solid foods is nothing to do with hunger, it's to do with them exploring their world, then whether or not they're ready to swallow the food is actually irrelevant. That will come later. There's a heck of a lot of exploring they can be doing way before they start to swallow anything. And it seems such a pity to withhold that from them just because they haven't shown that they're ready to swallow solid food.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was quite insightful. A couple of things you said there. I hadn't thought of it from that different perspective. So I guess, well, is there an age where you want to have introduced foods by? Like, for example, I've heard people say that you need to have introduced them to some variety of foods before a year, but I haven't actually come across anything to back this up. I guess I'm asking, is there a window of opportunity?
There probably is, in terms, again, of the baby's sort of curiosity and interest. A normally developing, a typically developing baby is going to be wanting to put things in their mouth from at least around 6 months old onwards, and most will be doing that definitely by about 8 months. So, and I've found with babies who are baby-led weaned, they often spend that couple of months really not eating much, but just exploring food. They tend to begin to eat more purposely from about 8 or 9 months. So I guess my perspective is we're not really doing the introducing, you know, we're just making it available to the baby and providing them with the opportunity. So why wouldn't we be doing that if the baby wants to have a go? It's also a little bit like if you were to ask me, well, when are you going to introduce walking? You know, when are you going to give him the opportunity to walk? Until you give him the opportunity, he's not going to actually do it. So, you know, there's an ideal time. I don't know about a window of opportunity because I don't think it would ever be too late. But nutritionally speaking, probably babies are beginning to need these other nutrients from around 6 months onwards. We don't know that definitely every baby does need them from then. It seems that a lot of babies are perfectly healthy, possibly up to a year without really eating anything else. But I wouldn't want to say don't introduce solid food, or it doesn't matter if you don't, because what you're missing is the opportunity for the learning and the tasting and the discovery that is really what baby-led weaning is all about.
Yeah. I wonder, is there, if anyone is concerned that their child isn't ready, is there any harm in waiting till, say, like 7 months to try them on, or to give them foods to try?
This is really tricky to answer. Do you know, part of the problem is we don't have the language to talk about introducing solids in these terms. We don't need to wait at all. We just have to be patient while the baby takes his time. So let's say you start offering your baby food to pick up and so on from about around about 6 months. Some babies, it might be slightly earlier if they are sitting up stably and they're reaching out and they seem eager, then maybe 5.5 months some might be ready, bearing in mind they're not likely to actually eat it anyway. I do hear often from parents whose babies at 7 or 8 months are still not actually eating anything of any quantity, you know, maybe a few bits have come through in the nappy, but nothing much. But that's just about giving the baby time. If what you're asking me is there a point where you actually make that decision for the baby and you actually have to do something to make sure they eat, I think that's a very, almost a dangerous idea. I don't know when that point would be reached, unless there was something medically wrong with the baby, or obviously there are babies who maybe have developmental problems or anatomical or physical disabilities or medical conditions where, you know, a different route has to be taken. I still would like to think they can do as much as possible by themselves, but I'm not saying we just kind of abandon those babies and say, oh, well, they'll do it when they're ready. That's not what I'm saying. But with a typically that developing baby, they will do it. And I do know of a lot of babies who haven't really been interested in eating until their year or more. But what are the options? To force feed them? And of course, what we see on the contrary is babies who are having their feeding controlled by adults, and maybe things are very difficult at the beginning or maybe not. But what you often find at around about a year is that they suddenly start to refuse food because actually they didn't want it, or they certainly didn't want to have it done to them. So I think any suggestion that we want to step in and do it to the baby is just so not baby-led and so unlikely to be necessary with a typically developing baby as just not to be a question.
Yeah, I think so. What I'm thinking of is my daughter is two, and when she was maybe 5 or 6 months, I would just be carrying her in one arm while I was out in the garden picking asparagus, and when I'd be carrying it back to the house, she would just reach over and she'd just chew on it.
Yeah,
just by her own sort of choice. She wasn't like swallowing it or anything at that age, but she just that sort of interest. So I guess that's kind of an opportunity for her that you're giving if she wants it. And then see, now she's two, but I would say she still gets the bulk of her nutrition from breast milk. Although she's got food on her plate if she wants it. Often she just likes to help herself to the food on my plate, but it's there if she wants to try it. So that's kind of the idea, right?
That sounds fine to me. I mean, what we really have to remember that for as long as breast milk is available, it's going to be almost a complete food. All of us could live very, very well on breast milk with just a few other things thrown in, just to kind of top up the micronutrients, really. And certainly at age two, you know, that is, if they had to choose one food that's the best food for her, there isn't anything else that has got anything like the kind of mix of nutrients that breast milk has. So it's going to beat carrots or apples or meat or eggs or anything any day of the week. Breast milk compared with any one of those is going to come out on tops. So if you have to choose one food as your starting point, make it breast milk and then offer other things to kind of top up with.
And I think the thing I've learned the most about baby-led weaning with my own children is understanding how effective their gag reflex is. Because I think there's some sort of, I think there are some misconceptions that baby-led weaning can be a choking hazard. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. Gagging is fairly common, probably less so if babies have been allowed to play with toys that they can poke into their mouth and discover how far back it's safe to put it and so on. But the gag reflex is often still very sensitive at around 6 months. Some people are tempted to suggest that parents wait till, let's say, 8-9 months before introducing anything other than purees, because the gag reflex will be less sensitive then. But first and foremost, I've seen a lot of babies gagging quite badly on purees. So it's not like they're immune from it if you don't give them solid foods. In fact, for a baby with a mouthful of puree, it's really hard for them to dislodge it, and they can't spit it out or pull it out like they can if they're holding onto the food. So actually they're a bit stuck, and gagging is usually more prolonged and more unpleasant for them. But just shoving a piece of, let's say, cooked parsnip a bit too far back, you automatically bring it out again. So, but what parents often don't, if they haven't seen this, they don't understand the difference between gagging and choking. And in fact, there are three things going on here. One is gagging, one is coughing, and one is choking. So gagging is that reflex, which is like a vomiting reflex. It's what you get if you stick your finger down your throat. And it's the back of the tongue kind of rises up and it pushes the food forward again. It happens a long way before the food is anywhere near the airway, especially in a young baby. So it's very protective, but it's nowhere near choking because the food hasn't got anywhere near that far back.
Yeah.
The second reflex is the cough reflex, which we will use as adults if a little bit of food goes down the wrong way, or, you know, you can cough and splutter on a glass of water. And the cough reflex, again, is just a reflex. And that's another one that sometimes babies will exhibit. And what they're doing is coughing out what's gone a little bit too far back. Again, that isn't choking. And if the baby's upright, then whatever is being coughed or gagged will come forward and out. What is choking is when those reflexes haven't worked or have been bypassed. And that's when something gets further back still and is actually lodged in the airway and partially or totally blocking it. And the real difference is that the baby can't dislodge it and often looks very distressed, maybe turning blue. But it's usually very quiet because they're not managing to get a decent cough to push it forward. So we obviously have to stay with babies while they're feeding themselves. But there's no evidence, and this is from research now, that baby-led weaning is any more risky than spoon feeding in terms of the risk of coughing, gagging, or choking.
So is that like each one is a bit further back? So gagging is closer, coughing is a bit further, and choking is further, even further still down the throat, is that right?
I guess that I mean, I'm not a speech and language therapist, or, you know, I don't have a training in exactly the mechanisms of swallowing, but I have educated myself among those people, and that's the way I understand it. Because the food would have to have kind of got past the place where it could be pushed forward or coughed forward in order to then block the airway. But certain foods are obviously going to be more risky than others. So we would always avoid round foods like grapes. We would cut them in half long ways, for example. And sausages, you know, we tend to take the skin off and cut them lengthways. But on the whole, babies manage extremely well. And it seems to me anyway that when the baby is in charge of putting the food in their mouth, they put it in the front of their mouth first of all, and that's where it tends to stay until they've developed the ability to move food back, which comes later after the early licking and chewing. Whereas when babies are spoon-fed, often the food is deposited further back in their mouth, so they're starting from a different place. The other thing, point that I think is relevant to this is that what we, again, are inclined to forget is that when we were starting solid foods at 3-4 months, we were still introducing what we called finger foods from around about 6 months, because we recognised that at that age, babies were interested in holding foods. And nobody was panicking about choking in those days. Suddenly there's this panic about choking in relation to baby-led weaning, when the only thing that's different is we're not doing 2 months of purees beforehand. You know, this is what we should be doing from 6 months onwards anyway, and always were. So it's actually not that different. I think sometimes people imagine we're giving pieces of food to babies of 4 months, and that's not the case at all.
So can you tell us what is wrong with spoon feeding?
I don't like to start a sentence with what's wrong with spoon feeding is, but there are a few things that I think make it less desirable. The first thing is that it's just not so much fun or so interesting for the baby. They rarely get to look at the food or have a good sniff at it or lick it or touch it before it's in their mouth. And from not only an interest and a curiosity and a learning point of view, from a survival point of view, that's probably something that is deeply inbuilt in us, that we want to check something out before it goes in our mouth. Not many of us would be really happy for someone to say, close your eyes and open your mouth and I'll put something in, you know. We don't like that. We don't feel comfortable, and we certainly wouldn't like that anybody who we didn't really trust to put anything in our mouth for us. And babies are the same. They want to check it out first. So spoon feeding tends to prevent them doing that. And because spoon feeding is usually purees, the format of the food also prevents them learning about that food. So apple puree doesn't look anything like a real apple. And one of the things we know is that children at the similar age to your daughter are often quite food neophobic, which means they're fearful and mistrusting of new foods. Well, for a lot of children, that's about the time they're actually being introduced to real table food, possibly a bit younger. Let's say from 15, 18 months, they will move on from purees to actual food that looks like what everybody else is eating. And we think, we know she likes apple. It's fine. Well, she doesn't know that this thing you're presenting her with now is the same as what she's been having all that time. And by the way, purees don't even taste the same as the real food, because the way the cell walls are broken down means that actually the taste is altered. So the business of purees doesn't allow children to get acquainted with food and to learn and to build a sort of database of what foods look like to match with how they taste and so on. It's also spoon feeding and purees, because they don't encourage chewing and big mouth movements. They don't encourage jaw development. And we know that soft foods tend to lead to narrower jaws and later on less well-fitting teeth and so on. So, which is one reason why orthodontists are quite interested often in baby-led weaning as a way to prevent that. And I guess the other thing with spoon feeding is that so often the baby is fed at a different time from everybody else. So the baby gets fed so that the rest of the people can sit down and eat their meal. Whereas with baby-led weaning, it's about shared meal times, which is why I say it's a whole approach, really, and not just about the method of feeding.
So I have read through your book, Baby-Led Weaning, and I had a couple of aha moments when I realised that, of course, baby-led weaning encourages a healthy relationship with food and an independent understanding of appetite control. Mm-hmm. So can you please share some more about this with us?
Yeah. If you like, baby-led weaning is mindful eating. A lot of adults are trying to recapture mindfulness in their lives, and one approach to maintaining a healthy body weight is to eat mindfully, to actually focus on what's happening in your mouth and so on. Babies are absolutely doing that. The whole of it, the whole of the process is fascinating for them. The noises that the food makes in their mouth, and the different textures, the sensations that they have. So it's a healthy way of eating from that point of view. It tends to be slower. Spoon feeding is often very fast, partly because perhaps the parent needs to get the baby fed so that they can serve up a meal for the rest of the family, but also because just by their nature, purees are swallowed very quickly. There's no chewing phase. So we all know it's easy to overeat if you eat quickly. So self-feeding allows babies time for their brain to get the signal from their stomach that they can stop eating and they're full. But I think almost more important than the appetite side of it, well, for me anyway, and what brings me to baby-led weaning, is the fact that with baby-led weaning, the decisions are the baby's. So there's no kind of coercion or bribery or threats. You know, if you don't eat that, you can't have your dessert, or if you eat this, we'll go to the park, which brings children up to equate food with a whole range of emotions that are just not relevant to the eating business. And so another one is offering food as a comfort. I mean, so many of us eat for comfort. I know I do. But that's not a healthy relationship with food either. We're eating for the wrong reasons if we're not eating related to what our body tells us it needs. So getting away from the emotions and the power games around eating is really what a big chunk of what baby-led weaning is about. And a lot of parents have said to me one of the reasons they've chosen baby-led weaning is because they themselves have had a distorted relationship with food. That might have been something like anorexia nervosa or just very limited diet and kind of being picky eaters themselves, whatever. They don't want that for their child. And so they want to actually step back and not put any of those pressures on a baby. And some of it we don't even recognize as pressure. So, for example, it's very common to praise a baby, you know, when they take a mouthful of food. Oh, well done, excellent, good job. Why? Why would you praise somebody just for eating? You don't praise them when they're formula feeding or breastfeeding. So why would you praise them with solid food? I don't praise my husband when he eats what I've cooked. You know, it's just either he wants it or he doesn't. You don't have to reward somebody with praise. And so immediately we do that. We're teaching the child to do it in order to please us. And again, it's a disconnect from their own body, which is really where they should be getting their signals from.
So before I had my own kids, I nannied for families and had gone through the process of introducing solid foods to four other babies. Mm-hmm. But this was before the parents or I had heard of baby-led weaning. So I look back now and cringe on all the spoon feeding I did to them. And especially because the very first food was rice cereal. Mm. And rice cereal and other similar foods were very common first foods since before I was even born. But the nutrition in these and other purees is quite minimal. So can you talk about the nutrition in pureed foods?
Yeah, I mean, rice is a really good example. It has so few nutrients in it. I mean, that's why we fortify it with iron, for example, because it just hasn't got any. So now iron fortified cereal is held up as the first thing we ought to be giving babies because they need iron. But actually, we should be giving them meat or eggs or if we're vegetarian, then pulses, things which are rich in iron. Not a food that isn't rich in iron is artificially reinforced. Rice cereal is common in many cultures as a first food for babies. And it's because in so many countries, it's cheap and it's a staple food. You're going to have it, and you know, even in COVID-19 lockdown, you know, there's every chance you've got some rice in your cupboard. So that's kind of how it came about, I think, was that it was such an easy food to prepare for babies and something you would readily have and that didn't cost money. Nowadays, of course, we've got a huge baby food industry, but the nutrition in shop-bought baby foods is usually very low. It's often lacking in nutrients. What it is very high in is sugar and with almost no fiber. And that combination of high sugar and lack of fiber is very damaging for our metabolic systems. There's more and more coming out about this nowadays, but it's not a good way to be consuming nutrients. And we talk about sugar being empty calories. It's worse than that. It's actually damaging to our systems. And the levels are so high because essentially it's so easy to become addicted to sugar. It is almost addictive. I think it is addictive. There's a lot of traction in that argument. And I don't think the companies are unaware of that. And if you can get a baby kind of hooked on baby food, then you're going to sell a lot of it.
Mm. See, now that you bring up iron, I watched an amazing TED talk during my first pregnancy by Dr. Alan Green. It's called 90 Seconds to Change the World. And it really opened up my eyes to how critical it is to wait to cut the umbilical cord when a baby is born. And just one of the reasons for that is to do with iron levels. Can you share this insight with us and its connection with introducing foods?
You're absolutely right. Yes, babies are okay. Often people describe breast milk as being low in iron. It doesn't have large amounts of iron. What there is very easily absorbed. But the real reason that it's lowish in iron is because babies under 6 months don't need iron very much. They've got most of it they get from the stores that they're born with. And as you've described, when they're born, if the umbilical cord is cut quickly before it's finished pulsating, then essentially the baby is cut off from its natural blood transfusion that it should get at birth. So it's entering life in the sense having already donated blood, which it actually needs. And it's so important in terms of stores of iron, which is why preterm babies may well need iron supplements before they're ready to start solid foods, just to kind of fill that gap, because the gap for them occurs a little bit earlier because they haven't been able to lay down those stores in the womb, having been pushed out a bit too early. I hesitate to use the word delayed cord clamping, which is what it tends to be known as, but because actually what we were doing before was prematurely clamping the cord. What we should be doing is letting nature play out until the cord has finished pulsing and has turned white, and then it's fine to cut it, divide it. And the baby's then got his full complement of blood and therefore stores of iron in his body. And those will tend to last him usually at least for the first 6 months and possibly longer. Again, the evidence we have about when babies start needing iron has largely been drawn from a cohort of babies who would have had their cords clamped early. So we're only now discovering that actually if you leave the cord to pulsate, the baby probably doesn't have that same need for iron at around about 6 months in such urgency as we've been led to believe.
Yeah, and I should add that 90 seconds is a nice catchphrase, but often that still isn't long enough. So
yeah,
I think you just said you want to wait until it's stopped pulsating and pumping and it's white and limp, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. That's a good way of telling. It's an interesting point, actually, that because we so like numbers, we want to know what age this, how many ounces of that, how many milliliters of this. And actually, we don't need those figures. And often, even when we have those figures, all they do is make us worry. So we just need to watch and listen and support nature.
Yeah. And so you said you don't quite like the term delayed cord clamping. I've also heard of optimal cord clamping. So I think it's finally becoming more mainstream. But I'm wondering, maybe you know this with your background as a midwife, but do you know if this is still done in emergency birth situations? Like I think you said before about preterm babies. Do you know, to me it would seem they especially can't afford that deficiency that results from immediate clamping. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I haven't practiced in midwifery for a number of years now, but at the point of birth, what is weighed up very quickly is what serves the baby best. And if what serves the baby best is to stay on his mother and to have that extra blood and so on, then that's the way it would be played. But if that baby's, for example, actually struggling to breathe, then they may need help with some suction and going over to a supply of oxygen, in which case, sadly, they often have to be taken away from the mum. Sometimes there are kind of interim things. It's possible to give a baby oxygen, let's say, while he's on his mum. But generally, especially in an emergency situation, let's say an emergency cesarean section, it would be reasonably common for the baby to have to be separated from the mum so that somebody can check it over quickly. It depends how premature the baby is and so on. But those are balancing risks, really. But I think the benefit of letting the baby stay attached to mum is at least being weighed up in that thinking now, whereas perhaps it wasn't there in the past because it wasn't recognised as actually having benefits.
Right, yes. Now, I want to just take us back to the beginning. What is your backstory here? Like, what first initiated your interest with this? Did you first come to this through having your own children?
No, not really. It was when I was a health visitor, public health nurse, and the role of the health visitor in the UK is we actually do a lot of the stuff that in many countries is done by a paediatrician. So we would do routine health surveillance, immunizations, developmental checks. And what we did an awful lot was counsel parents about infant feeding. And so I saw an awful lot of parents and babies struggling with the introduction of solid foods. Maybe they were, in those days, they were tending to start at around 4 months. And actually things sometimes went okay at first, but then they kind of broke down at around 6 or 8 months. And observing these babies, the parents would say, oh, you know, he won't eat this food. He doesn't like this food. And I kind of watched and I thought, I don't think it's the food. I think he doesn't like what's happening to him, what's being done to him. And I vividly remember a mum saying, this sounds like I always use the example of apple, but it just happened in this case. She said, he won't eat apple puree, but when I'm eating an apple, he wants to grab it. And I thought, this child is so clearly telling us what the problem is and what he wants to do. And I just said to her, well, maybe let him grab it then. Initially, the allowing babies to feed themselves became an answer to those sort of problems, those feeding difficulties. And because back then we still thought that babies needed food from 4 months, that I couldn't kind of go any further with that. But when the World Health Organization was moving closer and closer towards 6 months as the minimum or roughly minimum age, it all started to fall into place. Because the other thing that I was seeing when I was in those days, we did a developmental check when the babies were 6 months old. And there were certain things you were looking for that would tell you, yes, this baby is developing normally. So one would be being able to hold their head and trunk upright. One would be reaching out and grabbing things accurately. And one would be taking things to their mouth. And those were all feeding behaviours. But we didn't really appreciate them as such because the babies were already having food. So when I saw those behaviours and kind of joined up what was happening for babies at 6 months with what we were now being told their nutritional needs were, it just seemed obvious. And I think now, if we'd never had that history, that legacy of feeding babies foods much earlier than they really needed, if you were starting now with a blank slate and you knew that from around 6 months, babies would begin to start needing other foods, and you had a baby who was reaching out and grabbing things and taking them to their mouth, why would you even imagine that you would start pureeing stuff up and poking it in with a spoon? I don't think it would enter our heads. This is just this legacy that we've got from the way we used to do things.
In these observations of yours, did this kind of correlate with the time when you were beginning to do your master's degree?
No, this is earlier than that, because I qualified as a health visitor in 1978. So this is kind of during the 80s and 90s, really. I was seeing this. And I was in some ways thought of a bit of a maverick by my colleagues because I was encouraging so many mums and dads to let their babies feed themselves. But it just seemed to work. I couldn't do then was kind of give it a name. The master's degree was focused on of offering babies the opportunity to pick up food from around 4 months onwards and seeing when they actually did it. And some did it before others, But one of the interesting things I found was that it was only a very small group of babies, but none of the babies I looked at actually ate anything or had anything in their nappy until they were around 6 or 6.5 months, even though some of them were already taking food to their mouth before then. So it seemed like they were programmed to do this at the right time.
So is there anything I haven't asked you about baby-led weaning that you'd like to add?
Well, there's probably tons I could talk about it all night, but that won't work for you. I can't think of anything in particular, really. The most people often ask what is kind of the most difficult thing for parents. And I think it is trusting your baby and stepping back and letting them have control. And on the one hand, baby-led weaning flows quite nicely from breastfeeding, because actually a breastfed baby feeds himself. You can't do breastfeeding to a baby. You can only offer them the breast. And if you've ever tried to persuade a baby to feed at the breast when they don't want to, you know that it's impossible to make them. Yeah. Slightly different with bottle feeding. You can actually persuade a baby and actually put the bottle in their mouth. So it's a bit different. So breastfeeding is essentially self-feeding. And I see baby-led weaning as on a kind of continuum from that. It's a natural progression, if you like, of self-feeding. I can't actually remember where I was going to go with that.
Something about the difficulty of...
So parents who are still breastfeeding when their baby is around 6 months have actually discovered that the way to make it work is to hand over the control to the baby, to let the baby decide when to feed and for how long and so on. We know that imposing restrictions and trying to control the process is where most of the problems stem from. So therefore, parents who then morph into baby-led weaning possibly find it a little bit easier because they have already entrusted that to their baby. And they know that their baby will eat what he needs because they haven't been able to measure it anyway. You know, they're kind of halfway there. If it's going to be a little bit more difficult, it's possibly for parents who have been used to actually measuring amounts and feeding on a slightly more of a schedule, which you often get with formula feeding. So sometimes parents who are used to that find it a little bit harder to step back and trust their baby. I think that's possibly the only missing bit that I would like to add from what we've talked about.
Yeah. So I will put links in the show notes to your website, repleyweaning.com, and to your 5 books. Is there anywhere else you would recommend listeners go to find out more or get in touch with you?
Well, not specifically to get in touch with me, although actually they could follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jill Rapp on Twitter. I don't do a great deal of tweeting, but it's a way for people to contact me. Mm-hmm. I am hoping to revamp my website shortly, but that's neither here nor there. There may be a different website address, but there will still be a link through the existing one. There are lots of forums and Facebook groups and so on about baby-led weaning because it is very popular. And in fact, it spread through the web before I ever wrote a single word about it. And I would encourage people definitely to go and meet up online or in real life groups with other parents who are doing it, but just to be a little bit cautious, because sometimes what's described as baby-led weaning is not the way I describe it. Equally, some of the kind of groups are a little bit exclusive, so that if you've ever given your baby anything with a spoon, you're not allowed in the group. I'm not supportive of that. Parents must do what they want. In fact, there is just one more thing, if I can just add it while I think
of
it. Often I'm asked, can you do a bit of both? Can you do a bit of spoon feeding and a bit of baby-led weaning? And the answer is, you could do a bit of spoon feeding and a bit of self-feeding. But because baby-led weaning is this approach that involves family meal times and the baby being in control, strictly it's not baby-led weaning at that point. But you can sure mix spoon feeding and self-feeding. But you're not actually doing a bit of both. You're doing what conventional weaning looks like if you start at 6 months. Nobody's really described that, because all of our knowledge about conventional weaning kind of harks back to when we started much earlier and introduced the finger foods from 6 months onwards. if you start at 6 months, but you're doing it conventionally, then you probably do a mixture of spoon feeding and finger foods. So it isn't actually a bit of both, and it's not really baby-led weaning. But I wouldn't, anybody choosing that because it works for them, I absolutely wouldn't say you can't be a member of the club.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is quite important that we do define what baby-led weaning is, because when it comes to research or to people passing on knowledge to others, we do need to have a reference point for, hey, hang on a minute, this is what it actually is. It's a bit like the definition of exclusive breastfeeding. You know, we can't have meaningful research if we're not defining what we're studying. And similarly, if one mother says to another, well, this is baby-led weaning, and if they really want to be sure what it is, come back to the books I wrote with Tracy Merkit, because actually I'm the person who coined the phrase, so that is what baby-led weaning is.
Yeah.
People can do whatever they like. I don't have a problem with that. I just have a problem with what they're calling it.
So this also makes me wonder, if you're giving your baby the opportunity to eat some food, is there any advantage to giving them a spoon to practice with, or is it more effective to just let them use their fingers?
If you want to give them a spoon to practice eating perhaps runny foods like yogurt or something, that's fine. Mm. Sometimes earlier on, all they really need is a dipper, so just a kind of a breadstick or something like that to dip into food. Because they aren't able to scoop, that's quite a sophisticated skill.
Yeah.
But sure, they can try, why not? But if we're thinking about actually introducing our baby to cutlery as a way of feeding themselves, there's no reason why a spoon is what you'd start with. In fact, why would you if you're giving pieces of food? In fact, many babies manage better with a fork to start with at, say, around about 10 months. They can stab something much more easily than they can scoop. And it makes much more sense with the consistency of the food that they're being offered. But by all means, if you want to offer your baby something runny and give them a spoon to have a go with, yeah, why not? Or pass them a spoon already loaded. That's another way to do it. What we need to do is think about which foods is it reasonable to use a spoon with, which foods do I use a spoon with, rather than imagine that because you have a baby, they're going to need a spoon.
It's such a good point. Like I said, my daughter is two, and she definitely prefers a fork. She always wants to have the same cutlery that we're using.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. So did you want to just briefly tell us about your books?
Well, I wrote them in conjunction with Tracy Merkit, because her background is in journalism, so she's kind of a wordsmith. I enjoy words and enjoy writing, but I tend to use long words where short ones will do. So she also did baby-led weaning with her own baby, whereas I had not had that opportunity because mine were grown up by the time I was thinking about all this. So we made a very good team, and we wrote the original book called Baby-Led Weaning. In the UK, it's called Helping Your Baby to Love Good Food. I think the US version is Baby-Led Weaning, The Essential Guide, and sorry, there's another long bit, but I can never remember that. They are the same book, in fact, but they've just been adapted for the American reader. That was back in 2008, and it's just been updated last year, 2019, in both countries. And it's also available in about over 20 languages now. We've also written a couple of cookbooks just to give some recipe ideas, not because we have to cook food specially for babies. This is about families sharing meals. But because we recognise that an awful lot of parents, especially with their first baby, haven't really done a lot of cooking themselves. It's a generation that's grown up with a lot of ready-made meals, and they've perhaps been holding down, you know, jobs with long hours or whatever. And so they haven't often done a lot of cooking. So the cookbooks are really just recipes for family meals that are simple and easy to follow and that are safe for a baby to share, because they don't have the sort of salt and sugar added and that you would want to avoid. Even if you were spoon feeding a baby and making your own baby food, you wouldn't be giving. So I didn't mention that, but the list of foods to avoid is the same with baby-led weaning as it is if you were making your own baby food. So it's about making meals that the whole family can share because they're suitable for the baby. We also wrote Baby-Led Breastfeeding, which is just quite a nice book about how to get started with breastfeeding and what to expect and how to kind of stop it when you're ready and you and your baby are ready. deals with the common problems and so on. And we've another book called Baby-Led Parenting, which looks at baby-led breastfeeding, baby-led weaning, but also issues around play and discipline and just generally having a baby-led approach to bringing up your baby.
Nice. And where would you prefer people to buy your books?
Wherever they tend to buy their books. I mean, we are available on Amazon, but equally, I would like to think people are happy to support independent bookshops as well. I'm not sure if all of them are available in every country, even in English, but I guess just to find out if it's available, Amazon is a good place to start, whether or not you end up actually using them to purchase the books.
Well, Jill, this has been such an enjoyable conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, I've been delighted. Thank you very much.
My final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
It would be, I'm not sure if technically it's one sentence, but it's one thought. It's watch your baby, listen to your baby, trust your baby, respect his or her, I keep saying his, I'm sorry, it's a habit, but respect his instincts and abilities and let them guide you when it comes to feeding.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.